Well, Slaughterhouse 5, Player Piano, Breakfast of Champions, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Slapstick, and his latest, Galapagos. Kurt Vonnegut's writing reflects many paradoxes. He writes comic novels about despair. He's an atheist who's obsessed with all the questions about life that religion responds to. He warns that cultures are frequently irrational, but he believes in the importance of belonging to a group that shares your beliefs and values. Vonnegut was born in 1922 in Indianapolis and grew up during the Depression. His father was Indiana's first licensed architect. He studied science in college. The many ways we can hurt ourselves with our latest technological innovations has remained one of his themes. During World War II, Vonnegut was a POW in Dresden when the U.S. firebombed the city. He was one of the few survivors. The experience became the basis of one of his most popular books, Slaughterhouse 5, which was also adapted into a film. Slaughterhouse 5 is also the most frequently banned of Vonnegut's books. Although he has described his books as no more dangerous than a banana split, Vonnegut's books have been taken off the shelves of many libraries and banned from many schools. Because he's had so many firsthand encounters with censorship, he's active in the movement of writers to defend First Amendment rights in America and to protect free speech abroad. As an officer of the writers' organization PEN, he recently traveled to Poland, East Germany, and Czechoslovakia to report on intellectual freedom there. He's in Philadelphia to speak at an ACLU dinner this evening, honoring Ernesta Ballard for her women's rights work. I should mention, though, that the dinner is already booked up. If you're interested in seeing him tonight, unless you already have tickets, you won't be able to do it. Kurt Vonnegut, a great pleasure to meet you. And
no,
welcome
thank you.
To Fresh Air. You've always described yourself as sad and pessimistic. And I wonder if you think that has anything to do with growing up during the Depression.
Well, I would suppose so, but it has more to do with hanging out with scientists. If you hang out with scientists, you find out you're really not entitled to be optimistic. Of course, if you hang out with lawyers or with graduates of the Harvard Business School, there's every reason to be cheerful and optimistic. But my brother, Bernard, is a distinguished scientist. He's much older than I am, and I have always followed him around and hung out with his friends who've been scientists. And they tell me quietly now that the game may virtually be over biologically for mankind, that we may have poisoned the planet to that extent, lost that much topsoil, poisoned that much water, or whatever. And so to Lucille Ball, or to, again, a graduate of MBA school, or a lawyer, is nonsense. Cheer up.
I get the impression, though, that you early on thought of science as having an almost religious value of being a savior.
Well, I notice these ads still in The Nation and in other small publications as the technocrats are still around. And the Depression was quite interesting in a lot of ways, particularly if you were middle class, as I was, so you didn't get hurt that badly, and there was still an awful lot to see and think about. But during the 30s, it was felt that the American form of capitalism had collapsed and would not rise again, and that there'd been something wrong with it because the factories were dead then and there was very little work. And so people were trying to think of ways, better ways, than the sort of economic anarchy we'd had up to then to rig the country and, in fact, rig the world. And so fascism had its backers in Indianapolis, Nazism, communism, moderate socialism, and technocracy was one of them, and that sounded like the right one to me, which was to put engineers in charge. And certainly this experience with the shuttle, which blew up, would make you a technocrat, because the engineers who actually understood the risks did not want this thing sent up. And the optimists, the managerial type, said, nonsense, it'll be all right, send it up.
You followed in your brother's footsteps for a few years. He was a scientist, and when you went to college at Cornell, you majored in science there.
I could only go to college if I took something practical, as my father said, and I wasn't the sort of person who was going to work his way through through college. And actually, in those days, college didn't matter that much, and I think I wanted to be a journalist, and would have liked to have been a journalist, And the thing for me to do, really, would have been to save my parents what little money they had left and to go to work on a newspaper, which I could have done.
Why didn't you?
Because my parents, I think it was important to them that I be a college graduate. It wasn't important to me.
Well, what soured you on science? Was it studying science in college, or did something else make you give up on that as the solution for our problems?
I've written about it a little, and I was such a technocrat and so fond of my brother and his friends, and really quite excited by a lot of the technology that was coming out of the Second World War. I was an infantryman. I liked a lot of it. But then I said I was so confident that science was making great strides that I thought I would see a color photograph of God on the cover of Popular Mechanics before I died, that we were making strides that quickly. But then when I got home from the war, his progress was dropped on Hiroshima. And that was unbearable. And that was horrifying. And I happened to be with my brother Bernard, the physicist, who's 9 years older than I am. I had just come home from Europe, having been a prisoner of war, and I was in Indianapolis, and he was there too. And we got the news that they had dropped this thing on Hiroshima. He hadn't had anything to do with it. He'd been working on de-icing airplanes during the war. But, boy, he realized the implications of this thing is a tremendous increase in violence at the fingertips of mankind. And so he was petrified and amazed, and so I was petrified and amazed too, and remain so today.
The hazards of the technology that we create has become one of the themes that you've written about. Your early books were reviewed as if they were science fiction. Did you see yourself as writing science fiction, and did you want to become a part of that science fiction community?
There remains today a prejudice against people who understand technology, because the sort of people who become critics is they customarily English majors who know nothing about what goes on in the physics department or the chemistry department. Sure, it's terrible, and that those people are dumb over there and all that. And if you look at the typical New Yorker story, or a lot of movies too, is a man is particularly charming if he has no idea what goes on under the hood of his car, and you know can't even change a doorknob or a light bulb and all that. This is all charming. Well, it's charming to a certain sort of person. Not to me. There is this prejudice that someone, if he understands or she understands how the refrigerator works, couldn't possibly be sensitive too, couldn't possibly be poetic. And as I've written about this too, that here that probably the greatest novelists of all time existed in Victorian times, as they described character brilliantly and society, leaving out one aspect of the human experience, which was sex. So that this was a rather grotesque misrepresentation of life, finally, having that enormous force not acknowledged. And so we have people now in houses full of gadgets where the television set is the most important personality in the household, still writing as though the gadgets that govern our lives now had nothing to do with life. So that people who leave technology out of their novels now are as absurd as the Victorians who left out sex.
One of your recurring characters, Kilgore Trout, is a science fiction writer.
A terrible writer, really. He has an awful time with. He has great ideas, but he has a lot of trouble with the language.
It seems to me every time I've read you referring to science fiction, it's been with great sarcasm.
Well, because so much of it is simply awful and has had such low standards, and with good reason. When the electric typewriter was invented by IBM, IBM thought maybe they were crazy because nobody was complaining about typewriters at that time. They went fast enough. They weren't making much noise anymore. And they brought out the electric typewriter, and the first people to buy them were the science fiction writers and the pulp writers, because the faster they could go, the more money they could make.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. You come from a long line of atheists, and I was wondering if you ever considered rebelling and becoming religious.
Well, I have on occasion, and I've certainly made use of it. And, I'm not foolish. I realize it is a resource, but only an extremist if I resorted to it. I enjoy rituals, as I think it's proper to get married in church because it is a community activity, and it would be important whether they were God or not. I also like welcoming a child to the community, to a community, and so I approve of christening. But that's a human activity, clearly, and it's not significant whether God participates or not. The community is reason enough. But when my division went into action in Europe, as we'd never fought before, and so we moved up to the front and we took over positions that had been held by the 2nd Division, a real tough, experienced outfit. And I thought something should be said about this, that there should be some sort of ritual, some comment. And the Catholics set up a tent not far behind the lines. And they were the only people who thought this was worth commenting on, as this life and death situation that we had suddenly been lured into. So I went over there. And I didn't take communion. But I went down on my knees and did all that, again, as a community activity.
There's that expression that there are no atheists in foxholes.
Well, that's not quite true, because I did wind up in a foxhole, and I was much as an atheist as ever. But I wanted a rite of passage. And I think one thing is I studied anthropology and took a degree in it, finally, at the University of Chicago. But I think one of the distressing things in our society is that there are so few rites of passage now. If children are not welcome to the community as a matter of form, they are not welcome to adulthood, except I think one of the strengths of the Jewish people, for instance, is the ceremony which introduces you to adulthood. I think that is terribly important. And the only puberty ceremony most of us have, persons like myself, is getting our driver's license. and you know, our puberty can be revoked.
How about drinking legally?
Drinking legally, well, that comes a little later in the game. It's actually the driver's license thing at 16 is timed just about right. But your puberty can be revoked.
You've written that without religion, there's nothing to tell you what to want, what to shun, and what to do next. Did you ever feel that your life needed something like that to inform your decision-making?
But we're in a remarkable country. There are a whole lot of instructions in our Bill of Rights, particularly, about how to act. There are quite respectable guidelines about how to treat others, to allow them to believe what they believe, to say what they say, not to inflict your religious views on someone else and that sort of thing. There are quite strong deadlines and quite strong guidelines. And that's what's remarkable about this country. It's a pretty good country. If it weren't for the Constitution, it'd be just another big junky country like Argentina or something like that.
You're very interested in the idea of communities, both in your nonfiction and in your fiction. Are there communities that you really wanted to be in or communities you really wanted to get out of?
I have been ejected by one community, which was General Electric, as I worked there as a public relations man. And I would be there still, I think, if they had taken me into the General Electric family, and I might have had a pretty good job. I'd be close to retirement now, but I felt that, and mine is certainly not a tragic story, but I yearn for extended family, and I think everyone does. As Freud saying, he doesn't know what women want. I think they want reasonable extended families. I think they want to be surrounded by relatives and a support system, a human support system.
You actually became part of an extended family in a very dramatic way, and I'm thinking that when your sister died of cancer, I think, you adopted three of her children and brought them up as your own.
Yeah, but that's only, well, I used to have three children, then I adopted three more. That made six. Extended family, I'm talking about 50 or 100 people, is the sort of thing that's ordinary in Nigeria for instance. There are three big tribes there, but regardless of tribe, each person had 100, 200, 300 relatives in the immediate neighborhood that can be called on for help or whatever. And in this country, because we are a nation of immigrants still, if you want somebody to water your houseplant while you're gone, you have to call the fire department. You know, if you're lonesome, you call the police department. You call the government for everything because you don't have a support system of a whole lot of friends in the area.
There's a name that you made up for a fake community, a community formed for false reasons or for shallow reasons.
And Grand Falloon, yeah. And that is a very proud, utterly meaningless organization. And I give examples. Nations, certainly, are one. And that was in Cat's Cradle. I was talking about people from Indiana. Oh, my God, are you a Hoosier? I'm a Hoosier, too, and so forth. And to be from Indiana is meaningless, yet comforting.
Do you think it's a kind of desperation for
of course.
Extended community or extended family that makes us form alliances with people because we share the same name or we come from the same city?
Yeah, but there is the American disease is loneliness. And I think Europeans, those who have not been thrown out of their own countries, have no idea what this American disease of loneliness is like.
No, but you left the community that you were brought up in, you left Indiana, and you left your nuclear family there to move to New York. Did you ever feel bad about that? Was that a wrenching experience when you left?
Well, it was sad in a way. I'm trying to
trying to think of why you did it.
I'm sorry. I don't feel sorry. Uh-huh. As you brought up a subject I really haven't thought very much about. And one thing that made me particularly mobile, and I had the example of my brother who had left Indianapolis long before, is that we both belonged to professions, which means I was a writer. He was a physicist, which means that we belonged to extended families. We didn't have to create them. And so wherever he goes in the world, he's regarded as a brother by scientists anywhere, Warsaw Pact, China, anywhere. And this is true of physicians, too. One of my sons is a doctor, and anywhere in the world he belongs to an extended family. And I belong to an extended family of writers. And once you've established a reputation as a writer, people in other arts regard you as distant cousins, treat you as such, as composers and painters and so forth. So I really accidentally solved the extended family problem.
I was just wondering how much your family has given you that kind of nourishment that people would seek in an extended family. And I'm thinking that you've had like a second chance almost because you're in a second marriage and you have children who are already grown up, but now you have a daughter who's three.
Yeah.
So are there all kinds of things you're doing differently now, or do you see family differently than you did
well,
with
I see
your first
myself,
family?
I see myself differently, and this three-year-old child, I'm an old geezer now, and so I know what the actuarial tables say, but my wife, Jill, who has been on this show, I guess, Jill Kremitz, had never had a child and very much wanted one, and it seems to me that keeping somebody from having a child is keeping somebody from voting. There's nothing in the Constitution about it, but anybody who really wants to have a child while on this planet should have it. So I will really be old by the time this child graduates from high school, and so that troubles me. But I'm certainly interested in her as a biological experiment, is to watch her grow up. I am enchanted. And I work at home, and so I see her hour from hour. And it's this marvelous experiment, teaching her language. She's learning it, and it's a lot of fun.
My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. War has had a terrible impact on your life and also is an important subject for your writing. And one of the novels that was directly based on an experience you had is Slaughterhouse-Five, which I guess the idea for that came from an experience you had when you were a prisoner of war in Germany,
yeah.
in Dresden, during the time that the Americans firebombed.
Americans and the British.
And the British, yeah. Can you explain how you survived that?
Well, it was merely a matter of luck, as there were no air raid shelters in Dresden because an air raid was not expected. The Germans had believed it to be an open city. There, in fact, is no convention in war. I guess there was in medieval times, but they did not expect an attack, and there didn't seem to be any strong reason to attack it, so there were no air raid shelters. And it was a beautiful city like Vienna or Budapest. Or Prague, and one night, as the British came over, they're the ones who did the firebombing, really, the Americans dropped the high explosives, but the whole city was burned down, and all there was to hide in was cellars, and we happened to be quartered, our work crew of American prisoners of war was quartered in the slaughterhouse. One thing, there weren't many buildings around, there were just a few large buildings. So the firestorm wasn't very intense there. Also, we were in a meat locker way under the street, so it would have been the place for Hitler to be, anybody to be. It was the safest place in Dresden, accidentally. So that's how I survived.
And then when the bombing was over, you had to go upstairs and dig out corpses.
Well, what we did first was the city had to cool off before we could walk around. It was like a volcano or something like that. You had to wait for the lava to cool off. But we stayed down for quite a while, I forget how long, and finally came back up. And then we had to walk and walk and walk until we could find someplace else to stay. There was nobody to lead us. I mean, we just had guards who were corporals and privates and sergeants, and they didn't know where the hell to go, and there was nobody for them to ask. So they marched us out on the edge of town and found us a place to stay out there. But then the city began to get organized, what was left of it and all that, and we were organized into work crews to go in and dig bodies out from underneath the street. And I have looked at movies of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany, where the SS was made to carry the corpses to the lime pits or to the graves or whatever, while a whole lot of people watched. And the moral situation isn't analogous at all, but the political situation is I have carried corpses while civilians watched. And thought it served me right to be carrying corpses.
What do you mean?
Because I was an American, and the corpses had been created by Americans and British.
It's a really odd situation for you, because you were being held prisoner by Germans, and mm-hmm. your ancestry is German.
Yeah.
And then you narrowly survived bombing by bombers from your own country.
Yeah.
So you were connected and really attacked by your own people on both sides.
I've been attacked by the Russians. I was captured by the Russians after the war. and they held us prisoner for a while until they could exchange us one for one for Russians that the Americans had.
Did the bombing and the stench of the bodies that you were digging up afterwards haunt you? Did those memories haunt you for years?
No, if you were... If you were imagining it, as yes, of course it would, so the person would be colored for the rest of his life by this stench in his nostrils and all that. This was a wonderful teenage adventure in my life. I wouldn't have missed a moment of it. It did not wound me at all. These things that happened when I was 6 years old will go a whole lot. We'll explain far more thoroughly what I am than Dresden. No, it was a great adventure. I loved the whole damn thing.
You really did.
Oh yeah, and I liked being in the infantry. I wouldn't have missed it.
I'm just so surprised to hear that.
Well, it's wrong for a pacifist to like war that much, but I found nothing to object to.
I guess it's part of being young
for
you. When did you realize you were going to write about it? Was it then or years later?
I felt that it just kept nagging at me. It took me a while to realize that this was an important historical event, and it turns out to have been the largest massacre in European history. Now, massacre is something that happened suddenly. As heaven knows, Auschwitz killed many, many more people, but slowly, you know, in an industrial manner. And in just one big whoosh of killing a whole lot of people suddenly, Dresden held the record, and I had been there. And so I decided, I'd better write about this, because I was a professional writer, and I was always casting about for what to write about next. It took me a long time to do.
Did the writing about it change the way you remembered it? Did it bring back memories that you hadn't remembered, you know, things that you hadn't remembered? Or did you see it through a different filter because you were older then and had experienced more?
Well, I wrote, for one thing, I had one of the filters I'd seen it through was war movies about World War II and war books. And, of course, they featured Frank Sinatra and Duke Wayne and all that. And it took me a long time to realize that this war was, in fact, fought by children, you know, and not these middle-aged 4F movie actors. And so that's what one thing made the book bizarre, that, in fact, the infantrymen were teenagers, which is not usual in an American war story.
You've joked that you're not only one of the few survivors of that bombing, but you're the only person to have made a profit from it, because through royalties for your book, you've made about $3 per person killed in Dresden. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced what's sometimes called survivor's guilt.
Probably in some other situations, not the Dresden situation. I did lose several friends. There were 100 of us in that prisoner of war camp, a little labor gang in Dresden, and 5% of us died, didn't make it back home for one reason or another. That's not enough to give you survivor's guilt, I guess. I will issue the challenge again here, because the people have, a lot of people get mad at me for having talked about the destruction of a Nazi city, you know, and I saw it, which is the reason I wrote about it, and there's no reason for me to keep it secret that I saw it. But another thing is that absolutely nothing was gained by it, and I'll issue the challenge again here, that nobody in this whole world benefited from that air raid but me. That not one person got out of Auschwitz a microsecond earlier, not one German soldier fell back from his foxhole on the Russian front or the American front. Nothing was changed at all. And I'm the only person who benefited, and I got $3 and maybe $4 for each person killed there. And so this is going out over radio. I've done it on BBC and so forth, and that first letter has yet to float in. It's, hey, if it weren't for Dresden, I... whatever.
The book that was based in part on your experience, The Slaughterhouse Five, was also made into a movie. Were you happy with the adaptation?
Oh, I loved it. And I've often said that Margaret Mitchell and I ought to be crazy about Hollywood. Probably nobody else should be. But most satisfactory movies is mine and Gone with the Wind.
My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. You have said that you see the artist as a kind of alarm system that, you know, that the artist is well, why don't you explain your canary in a coal mine theory of art?
Well, as I understand it, coal miners used to carry canary birds down into the mines with them to let them know that there was poison gas in the mine so they could get out, and the canary bird would keel over before the men would get sick. And so I've said that was a function of the writer. And I think it generally has been. Norman Mailer talked a little about it at the Penn Congress, is that writers have more time to think about life than most people do, as most people have such absorbing jobs and are so tired when the day is done that they have done very little thinking about life itself. And we have this specialized class which is paid to really think in detail about life and to respond more to the news than most people can afford to, and so forth. And so we are a pretty decent alarm system, I think.
If you see yourself as an alarm system, what are some of the things you think you are trying now or have tried in the past to warn your readers about?
Well, it all depends on my mood, whether I want to be an alarm or not, because I'm attracted to creating simply works of art, which are self-referential, you know. It's just to write a good novel without its having any political purpose. Now, if I lived in Poland or Czechoslovakia or East Germany or Soviet Union, I would have to hide political ideas in my seemingly innocuous poems or plays or novels or whatever. But that's a waste of a work of art. And in a free society like this, I can have a didactic side, just writing to the New York Times or talking into this microphone. And so when I write a novel, it's simply a novel, is it? And so I would say, as a didactic person, I'm a pretty good canary bird. I wouldn't be a canary bird in a novel necessarily, is keeling over in a novel as a political warning.
Most of your novels are humorous, and I was wondering if you see yourself as having been influenced by any stand-up comics or movie comics.
Oh, absolutely, and I think talking about the Great Depression and all the options we considered, since it appeared that our economic anarchy was impractical and we're going to have to invent a new society, I think it's marvelous that we did not become a fascist country, because, you know, putting everybody in uniform and organizing artificial families in each block and that sort of thing. So we came very close to it. What kept us from going in that direction was the quality of the art at the time. Comedy and jazz, both on radio. His radio saved us. And the comedy and the music offered such profound spiritual relief that we did not go politically crazy. And I think that sort of relief was not available in Germany or in Italy. So art saved us once, and it can do it again.
Who are some of the comedians that you're
especially fond of? Well, I think some of the greatest men of my time, and I don't mean this as a joke at all, is Stanley Laurel was a great man. I think Jack Benny was an exquisite artist. And Fred Allen was pretty good, as I could actually rank them. I think I cared so much. But I would suppose the greatest of them all, the most brilliant, was Jack Benny. But this is a hard message to get across, you know, that these people are very gifted artists and very useful. But, boy, they relieved me of a lot of angst. Is not only was the Great Depression going on, high school was going on. You could imagine the old one, too, is not only high school, but the Depression, too. And I would turn on the radio and listen to that absolutely first-rate, interesting, cathartic music and cathartic comedy.
I guess it makes you angry when people say, well, it's just popular culture and it's really not very important.
Well, it may be less important now because the performers of comedy aren't as well trained as they were then.
If you take someone like Jack Benny, a lot of his humor comes from a turn of the head or a movement of the arm. There's a lot of gesture involved in that. Yeah, and so when you're putting humor on the page, you have a completely different sense of timing, I think, and of how to tell a story or how to get a punchline across than someone who's doing stand-up or doing a monologue would.
Well, I will do a little of it, though, because I will carry a character from one book to another to give a fixed familiar point. And, of course, Jack Benny was famous for being stingy. And so the subject of money came up, and nothing more had to be said. They'd have to call in the fire department, the commie audience down, so the show could go on. But that stuff is so helpful to people. And Jack Benny came up through the School of Jewish Comedy and through vaudeville, is the amount of experience he had by the time he came to my attention. And Stan Laurel came from the musical stage, same place Charlie Chaplin came from. And so these people were exquisitely educated in timing and how to milk an audience.
My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. You've referred to yourself as part of the last generation of full-time novelists. Last generation of full-time novelists. What do you mean?
Well, 1922 is a key year, and for one reason or another, there are a lot of fairly well-known writers clustered around that date. It'd be James Jones, it'd be Bill Styron, be myself, and Mailer. As I think it's all 1920, 21, 22, 23 in there, and then by slight extension we pick up Updike and Vidal and so forth. And we were all able to get a start in this business because there was a booming magazine industry then. I supported myself. I quit General Electric and became a full-time freelance because of magazines. Paid so well. I paid so much better than General Electric. And so I was able to give myself my own MacArthur genius grant, you know, or my own Guggenheim, writing short stories for Collier's or Saturday Evening Post. And all those writers I've named, I'm sure they went broke at one time or another, needed money in a hurry, and wrote a short story and mailed it off and got a respectable amount of money back. Money-raising scheme no longer exists for writers. It's television that killed it, and ad agencies found, truthfully, that television was a much better buy for their clients than magazines. There was nothing malicious in it. But the magazines failed, and you can't mail a thing off to a TV station and expect them to buy it and send you money back. So the magazine industry used to finance us, and there is no such industry now.
So you think because of the economics of writing that it's very difficult for writers to be full-time novelists?
And one consequence is that your novelists, as you will have them, are people who are rich or have married rich. And so you are going to get more and more stories about Andover and Brown and Harvard and so forth, and these lives certainly deserve to be reported on. But I think you're going to have an upper-class literature because only the upper classes will be able to afford the time it takes to write a novel.
You've seen other changes in the publishing industry too, and one of those changes is the things that an author has to do to sell a book, because unless you have a bestseller now, I think a lot of people in publishing could care less.
Well, that's all they want to publish now, in many cases. That's all they're interested in, is these people from business schools have come up with this wonderful idea. Hey, why don't you publish nothing but bestsellers, you know, is why waste money on anything else? And so some extremely good writers in this country are having trouble finding publishers now because they only sell 25,000, 30,000 copies, which is nothing anymore. I think when the conglomerators first came in and the accountants and lawyers came in to look at what publishers had been doing up to then, those were usually family businesses, they said, hey, you're wasting a lot of money warehousing books. And publishers used to have warehouses out in the New Jersey salt marshes. They didn't even know where. And so any books they didn't sell went there. And the business people said, you can't afford to do this anymore. And so there are no warehouses full of books anymore, and books now have a very short shelf life, as if you get Walden Books or one of the big chains. Is computers are calculating at all times whether a book still deserves a space on a shelf, depending on how well it sold in the last couple of weeks. And so we don't accumulate a culture the way we used to. It's almost like a supermarket throwing things out.
What was your big break as a writer?
I've always done well. And my big break was that the magazines existed. And I never intended to make a heck of a lot of money. Is it doing well? I've always done as well as I would have if I had been a principal of a junior high school, for instance. Well, we have a nice car, and I have nice suits and snow suits for the kids and all that. So I've always done that well. And the critical breakthrough was Slaughterhouse-Five, as people finally decided I was a serious writer. And, I mean, it was the New York Times who said I was okay. Up to that time, my books weren't reviewed at all, or just in a list in the back of the New York Times book review is also received and noted or whatever, in a little paraphrase of the content of each book, supposedly. But it was Slaughterhouse-Five, and that was my fifth or sixth novel. But I'd written good books before that, and they're all in print now. I'm totally in print. And in 1965, I was totally out of print, and now I'm totally in print.
In the 1960s and early 70s, I think you were enormously popular on college campuses.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you felt about that, and if you felt the same kind of common bond with your readers that they felt toward you at that time.
No, because I didn't really show myself to my people. I would go on the peace marches, but I would just be part of a throng wherever it was, and I didn't lecture at all. I lecture a good deal now. I never appeared on campuses in those days, so people never met me and never saw me and probably didn't know what I looked like. My only representatives were my books, which is fine, as I would just as soon were that way today.
My guest is writer Kurt Vonnegut. As popular as your books are, they've also been banned by some school libraries, by some regular libraries. How do you usually find out about it? What do they tell you? And do you find out directly from the person who banned the book when it's banned?
No, you pick it up from newspapers, or you hear talk or whatever. You have to chase down cases of censorship. And of course, it's a huge country. My publisher and I have an agreement that whenever we hear of such a case, that our primary interest is in offering help to the librarian or the teacher who has gotten into trouble as a result of recommending a book by me. And we also tell the ACLU, I can't think of a case that we've reported to the ACLU that they didn't already know, because they have chapters all over the country, and I have no such spy system out. So it's catch as catch can as I hear about it. There's no reason for me ever to testify in court, and so I'm not a participant in any censorship case.
Can you describe some of the passages in your book passages that are responsible for them being banned?
No, neither can the book banners, as they customarily haven't read them. And these are nice people. They're usually not very well educated. They have kids. They want to help the community in some way. They run for the school committee. And so suddenly, for the first time in their lives, they are dealing with books since high school or whatever. And so they are over their heads. But there are organizations which will give them lists of bad books, which they don't even have to read. Are these books on your shelves? And so they will go, and indeed some of them are. There's an awful lot of them are out of print. There's apparently the basic list, which includes Slaughterhouse-Five. It also includes Deliverance and Catcher in the Rye. Apparently it was circulated. It's just Xerox now. It was apparently circulated by 1971, because no book on it was published after that time. A lot of the books on that list are out of print now, as they're so unpopular. But it's on the basis of this list that continues to be circulated that people decide books are bad without reading them.
You've actually suggested that book banners be given a little test to see if they've actually read a book from cover to cover since high school.
Yeah, this would be a joke to us, but not to them, as they would respond. I didn't have to read the book, as I already had enough people telling me how awful it was. I had my secretary read it. It's what one fellow said. I get letters from the Soviet Union. I'm published over there. I get letters of sympathy saying that they're so sorry my books are being burned over here, and that they want me to know that my books will always be available over there. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, they've made a great deal of the very minor and rare cases of censorship in this country. I think what's new is not the censorship, but the opposition to censorship. As I think for 200 years, people have been perfectly free to censor school libraries, public libraries. Nobody's opposed them. And what is new is that suddenly they're being opposed.
And you're part of that opposition. Is it?
Of course.
Is it the attempts to censor your own books that made
you
an activist?
No, I don't care at all. I would be offended as an American citizen. At the same time, I am deeply offended by Al Goldstein, publisher of Screw, by Larry, what's his name? Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, because they're putting the First Amendment in terrible danger for no conceivable gain except money and notoriety to themselves. The only way you can defend the First Amendment is defend it absolutely, is to allow anybody to publish anything he or she wants. But at the same time, you can be an abominable citizen, as Al Goldstein is. As I have a schmuck list. they're certainly on it. And I think it's Flint has said that he's done more to defend the First Amendment than anybody, you know, because he got shot and he's paralyzed. And that's no help to the First Amendment at all.
Well, you know, a lot of people will say, I'll do anything to a friend to defend free speech, but when it comes to pornography, I think it should be banned. Will you defend everything, no matter how?
I have to. As mm-hmm. I see no choice, but that isn't the same thing as being in favor of raping three-year-olds and soaking him in gasoline and throwing him off fire escapes. A large number of women are quite distressed by pornography. Now they are right. It is an assault on their dignity, at least, and it may be more dangerous than that. But to ascribe the sexual impulse to pornography, to imagine that pornography provides the blueprints for sex crimes, for hideous perversions and violence and so forth, it simply is not true.
People censor books because they think that the books are dangerous and they might undermine the value system that the person censoring the book holds. Do you think of writers as having that much power?
No, I don't think human beings are that vulnerable. I know of no one who was ever harmed by a book. And I really don't. And this is a case of pornography, too. Is Mr. Meese, is our attorney general, has his committee that's been touring the country. I guess they've finished now. And they have these people testifying in a little sort of canvas tent to prevent them being identified, talking about how persons who've been jazzed up by pornography have hurt them in one way or another, is rape them, abuse them, or whatever. And it's the sexual impulse and the nature of the human mind, particularly the sick human mind, and not Hustler magazine, that causes people to do this.
You've been active in an international movement to defend the intellectual freedom of writers and other people, and you're an officer of PEN, the writers' organization. You recently went on a trip to several Eastern European countries. What were you looking for there?
Well, we simply wanted to know how the writers were there and to tell them, hey, we're thinking about you, you haven't been forgotten, because the situation in Poland and in East Germany and in Czechoslovakia is quite pathetic. And activist, I guess maybe I'm an activist, but it's a futile activity. There's really very little pressure we can bring on a Warsaw Pact government. Now and then it works, as we have from time to time gotten a person sprung from jail, and our few successes make it worthwhile to keep trying. But there are a whole lot of writers we'll never even hear about who are in Siberia or whatever. It's worth a try, and our successes aren't numerous.
Do you feel that there is a big community of writers now? Do you feel this? Does the kind of work that you're doing for free speech give you a greater sense of a community of international writers?
Yeah. I would feel it in any case, I think. I talked about entering a profession and having an extended family. Doctors feel related to each other, regardless of what country they're in. So I would have that feeling about other writers, whether they were a pen or not. Also, there are some writers that I hold in utter contempt as political hacks and that sort of thing. And so they're not relatives of mine, they're enemies.
My guest is Kurt Vonnegut. You've taught teaching.
Taught writing.
Sorry. You've taught writing, and you've taught it over a period of several years. Yet, when you were young and first starting to write, you'd never been a student of writing or been a student of literature as your major in college. Do you think that hurt or helped you in any way? Because you were majoring in science, not in literature,
yeah,
or writing.
No, if I had met someone like myself, I would have felt a lot more confident about becoming a writer, and I also would have known a lot. Almost everything I found out about writing, I learned the hard way, whereas, in fact, it was all in Aristotle's Poetics. Now, there are a few fundamental things that are known about storytelling, simply because some stories have succeeded and others have failed. So I can be like a golf pro, is I can stand to one side and tell you to swing your club, and I'll say, all right, put a little more weight on your left foot, is move your thumb down a quarter of an inch, and the ball will go 50 feet farther, and you won't yourself know what the hell you were doing wrong, and the things you can do wrong in storytelling. I mean, these are mechanical things. So I can be helpful in that way.
Because you weren't studying literature and because you didn't have teachers criticizing your writing, was writing more fun to you when you were younger than it
and
might
reading,
have been if you were a serious student of
reading,
it?
Reading was a lot more fun, too. I've never done. I've always read for pleasure, and I've never had to explain afterwards what the author had done to prove that I had understood the book at all. And when I enter into literary conversations now, I don't have the vocabulary. I don't have the critical approach that most people who have come through seminars and all that. So I really can't speak literature very well.
Do you wish that you could?
No, because I think in my case it would be crippling. And I've said that English writers will come out of almost any department but the English department. And this is not to insult English departments. When I say this in a lecture, everybody says, oh, yeah, hoo-hoo, what a bunch of jerks in the English department. Well, it's not the purpose of an English department to turn out creative writers. It's to turn out literary historians, cultivated people, and people who will in turn teach people the wonders of their language and their literature. But one thing an English department will do will teach you good taste too soon. And so when you can't write very well but are starting out, you will be horrified when you compare yourself with James Joyce at the peak of his powers, or Proust or Mark Twain or whatever. And so when I was in the chemistry department at Cornell, writing for the Cornell Sun, I thought everything was wonderful. And I thought what I was doing, you know, I didn't know any better, so I dared to begin.
Well, your first writing in print, I think, was for first your high school.
Yeah, high school
newspaper.
And I went to a high school that had a daily paper. And then when I went to Cornell, I'd already been getting out a daily paper, so I had no trouble getting on the Cornell Sun when I was there.
Were you reporting?
For the Sun? Well, I finally wound up as managing editor, but I was at Cornell for 3 years until I went to war. But after the war, I became a police reporter in Chicago at the same time I was going to the University of Chicago.
Do you think that that helped you, trying to describe things in simple sentences as you saw it?
Well, it's the fault of my style, certainly. A lot of critics find it too simple. And the newspaper style has always seemed to me wonderfully honest, as you tell as much as you know as quickly as you can. And actually, all my books, I start out with saying what the book's about and how it's going to end on the first page and then get on with it. And I don't hold things in suspense, and I don't hide surprises along the way, because newspaper people don't do that.
I guess what you said is really true, because a lot of your books actually have introductions in which you explain what's going to happen in the book before you actually get to the body of the book.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the pleasure in a play, usually, is knowing what is going to come. Is a really successful play is so loaded with hints about what the third act is about that you're just thrilled by the third act when it all comes true.
Do you still read a lot for pleasure?
Well, I read a lot for social reasons now. I think people are really influenced by novels from between the age of 12 and 24, say. And whatever I am today, whatever my literary tastes are, whatever authors I admire, what my politics are largely determined by books I read back then. That was a long time ago. Since then, I have read books for information or to prove to myself and to others that I'm an educated person. And living in New York, I know a heck of a lot of writers. And so I read books because I know I'm going to meet this person very soon, and I don't want to lie to the person.
Well, you know, it's almost a reason for not reading the book, because the other way of looking at it is you read the book, say you don't like it, mm-hmm. you run into this writer who you'd like to think of as a friend, and you don't really want to insult them, and so what are you going to do, tell them the truth? And so I don't know how you handle that.
Oh, well, you lie if you want to. I mean, there's certain prices you pay for living in Philadelphia. I don't know what they are, but for living in New York, you're not truthful in your opinions of paintings or music or anything else. Your mate will know what you really think, but your friends won't, because the friendships matter.
You've been asked a lot to write blurbs for books, right?
Yeah, and I don't do it anymore, because for a while I gave a blurb to everybody, and I think part of my fame is based on the fact that I was on every book jacket for a period of about 10 years or so. But I had one person I knew. I gave him several blurbs, and he finally wrote a book that was so awful that I couldn't give him a blurb. There was just nothing in it of value. And so I refused, and in the middle of the night, I got a call from another writer who said, "You can't leave me on this book jacket all alone." But I don't give blurbs now, and it doesn't help to sell a book anyway.
You don't give blurbs because you don't need it anymore to get your name around?
I never did it to get my name around, as I was just trying to be a good fellow and thought it was part of my duty as a member of the writing community.
As you said before, when you first started writing, your books weren't even reviewed, and then you became very popular and had tremendous success. Your books were always reviewed, and many of them became bestsellers. How did that success affect you? For a lot of writers I know, it makes them more confident. For others, it destroys their equilibrium, and they don't know where they are anymore.
I already said that I'd always been able to make a living at it, and since I quit General Electric in 1951, which is a long time, and it was a perfectly decent income I was making, so it wasn't a shock. I think there were comical things that happened. I became reputable, not prosperous, but reputable, at the age of about 45. And at the age of 45, I was doing all right. I was making as much as a mayor of city of Gary or something like that, you know, and they had a pretty nice house. And so I got an award from the National Institute of Arts and Letters. And I went to the ceremony and everything and got the check. And these are checks are supposed to help young people just starting out. And there I was. My kids were practically full grown and I had a whole lot of books behind me. And so I bought a speedboat. That was absurd. I got a Guggenheim, finally, as a third application, fourth application, I guess, when I finally didn't need it very much.
Do you write now to make money? Or, I mean, I don't know if you have money to live on. I guess what I'm asking is, well, do you like to write?
I'm in the writing business. It's what I do. It's my sole source of income. It's a good source of income. In order to keep that income coming in, I have to write more books. My backlist, as well known as it is, doesn't sell sufficiently to put me on Easy Street. And no book has, I haven't had a huge movie sale, for instance, with which I could have bought a lot of stock or whatever. And so in order to continue living as well as I do, which is quite nicely, I have to keep working.
Is writing a pleasure for you?
No, not particularly. As I worry about the older my father got, the dumber he got, and I'm afraid that's going to happen to me. To me too, or maybe happening to me.
You're about to light up a cigarette.
Yes.
And I know once you tried to give up the Pall Malls that you smoke. You still smoke Pall Mall?
I'm sorry about this. I don't.
Oh, it doesn't bother me.
Well, I don't allow myself to be photographed smoking a cigarette because I'm not proud of it at all. And I think it's a catastrophic habit. And I'm just monumentally hooked. And you, before we went on, you said, is there anything you'd rather not talk about? Yeah, well, you hit on it. This is really a diseased condition.
Well, sometimes I think that writers more than anyone else have suspicions, superstitions wrapped up with writing that and cigarettes, that if you stop smoking, you won't be able to write, and you'll just never write again.
I've run the experiment.
Really?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think every smoker has quit at one time or another and has found out what the consequences are. And I think a lady from Philadelphia invented smoke enders, isn't that right?
I don't know.
I think so. As a wife of a dentist here who had a degree in psychology, when her kids were grown, she looked around for something to do and read all the monographs on smoking, everything that was known about it, and then worked up smoke enders, which is a really pretty good program. And you give up smoking, and it's easy to do. You take your time about it, and there's no hellish period you go through. But when I was through with it, I felt all right. But I did not write, could not write. And a number of people close to me, particularly my wife and a daughter who lived in New York, complained about the personality changes of which I was not aware.
That you'd become more irritable?
No. I probably became more irritable. I became more abrupt. I became loud. So the psychological consequences were considerable.
So you started again.
Yeah, but I, you know, talk about the taboo subject. This is it.
Okay, I guess we'll get off it. I hesitate to ask you this, but do you have any books of yours that are to you representative of your best work? Are there ones that you are?
Oh well, there are ones I'm particularly fond of. Sure, I've graded them one time. I gave grades to all my books, and it was just how I felt that day about each book. But I'm very pleased with my career. Here I am, 64 years old, or 62, and I never expected to write this many books, and to be satisfied to the extent I am with them. Because my grades weren't particularly good in school, and prognosis did not seem good. So I'm proud to have finished the book.
So which is...
What is my favorite?
Yeah,
I'm fond of The Sirens of Titan. But I like them all, and the one, Galapagos, is the latest one. Is people are saying, you know, it's your best book in a long time and all that, but the intervening books, particularly the one right before it, seems to me, Dead-Eyed Dick, is more literary and deeper in terms, I was dealing with things that mattered to me in depth in Dead-Eyed Dick, and I think I dealt with them quite well. The book wasn't that popular. But I think it's a good book, and so I'm particularly fond of it for personal reasons.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us.
Well, pleasure.
Thank you for being here. My guest has been writer Kurt Vonnegut, and he's the author of many books, including Dead-Eyed Dick and Slapstick, Cat's Cradle, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Slaughterhouse-Five. His new book is called Galapagos, and that one's published by Delacorte. He lives in New York. He's in Philadelphia to speak to the ACLU this evening. There's a dinner to give a special award to Ernesta Ballard for her work fighting on behalf of women's rights. And Kurt Vonnegut is here to present that award and to make a speech to the ACLU. I should mention, though, if you wanted to hear him there, that they're already all booked up. All the seats are taken. But his new book, if you want to read it, is called Galapagos. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 10 minutes after 4. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Anthony Lucas, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, whose latest book, Common Ground, which is a case study in urban racial conflicts, just won a National Book Critics Circle Award. So we'll hear from him in just about 5 minutes. First, we're going to listen to a record by clarinetist Kenny DeVerne. We heard an interview with him recently on Fresh Air, and just last week he was in the Delaware Valley to perform. Well, let's hear this recording from a recent record. This is What's New.